Maboff!
My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. This is Scammapalooza. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. And if you do enjoy the show, why not head to iTunes and leave a review? If you really enjoy the show, why not come to Scammapalooza Live on the 19th of January at Bella Union here in Melbourne. It's going to be a fantastic night of entertainment. We've got, obviously, myself. We're going to be joined by magician Dom Chambers, who you might remember is the viral superstar magician who was on the Dom and Dumber episode. Dr. Vyom Sharma, who is an outspoken critic of quack medicine. Game designer Ben McKenzie, who helped build the bank heist in here in Melbourne as well, as well as comedian Bree Williams, and a bunch of special guests who I cannot announce because they may not make it on the night. For more information on the show, check out conman.com.au. It's a big venue and we want a packet full of scammapaloozas. Anyway, on with the show. In Agatha Christie's classic thriller Destination Unknown, the character of Wharton is heard to remark, "Nobody's so gullible as scientists. All the phony mediums say so, can't see why." The hero of the book, Jessop, a British spy with a devil-may-care attitude, replies, "Oh yes, it would be so. They think they know, you see, and that's always dangerous." Nobody knows better than this than my guest on the podcast today, Stephen Greenspan. Stephen holds a doctorate in developmental psychology from the University of Rochester and is a professor of educational psychology at the University of Connecticut and a clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Colorado. He is also the author of the book, The Annals of Gullibility, Why We Get Duped and How to Avoid It. Not only that, Stephen was one of the victims of Bernie Madoff. On today's episode of Scammapalooza, I talk to Stephen about gullibility, why we fall for things, and what it was like to lose money to Bernie Madoff. My name's Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. I guess the main thing is, why gullibility? How did you end up having that as your area of expertise?
Well, I mean, one somewhat humorous definition of a psychologist is someone who studies things that he's bad at. I've always been somewhat gullible. I'm not the most socially skilled person. So partly because I grew up pre-sock vaccine days, and my mother was afraid that if I played with other kids, I might get polio, which was also why Howard Hughes became a germphobe, because he had the same problem. I didn't become a germphobe, but I never really quite cracked the social code as a child, and had several gullibility episodes, continue to have a few as an adult. But what really got me interested was when I started doing some consulting in criminal cases where people had been coerced into confessing to crimes that they were really innocent of, or coerced or manipulated into participating in crimes that were really of no benefit to them, that I became aware that this is a big problem, particularly people with mild to moderate cognitive disabilities, which is sort of my specialty. So that the
disabilities,
well, what used to be called mental retardation. Today it's called intellectual disability or severe learning disability and related, many related disorders, including autism. These are people who are extremely vulnerable. And the same thing is true of elderly people too, particularly those who are beginning to show some early signs of dementia. They're often manipulated, and of course they make attractive targets in part because they usually often have significant resources, and often they don't have anyone like a spouse around to look after them and protect them.
And so from there you started to see familiar patterns in behavior of gullible people, or was it something where it just didn't seem like there was a specific idea of what it gullible?
There are sort of two ways of being gullible. One is based on belief, believing of false things or being tricked into believing things for which there's little evidence. A better term for that is probably credulity. There was an interest in credulity in the early 20th century because there were so many social movements, quasi-religious movements such as spiritualism. And of course, that's always been a big theme in literature. For example, in the U.S., Mark Twain Herman Melville, the Confidence Man, not to mention, the idiot, Dostoevsky's the idiot, someone who was so naive that he really couldn't exist in the world outside of a monastery. And I'm more interested in gullibility that is not just a matter of belief, but it involves some degree of action, whether it's signing a check or doing some kind of overt act that puts you in harm's way. I mean, there's not really one single way of being gullible. It can take many different forms: romantic gullibility, political gullibility, economic.
I would imagine by the idea of looking for gullibility in action would allow you to measure how gullible someone is, whereas just gullibility and belief, I would imagine, just from an academic point of view, would be a lot harder to actually measure how.
Well, the interesting thing is that gullibility has been addressed more in fiction than it has by social scientists, in part because there are different factors that contribute to gullibility. And as you say, it's hard to know what's inside someone's head until they act overtly. I mean, the best way of knowing that someone is at risk of being gullible is whether they have been taken advantage of in the past, and whether other people think of them as gullible or whether they see themselves as particularly gullible. There's no really good measure of gullibility as far as I know.
That said, you have established your own model for what causes gullibility. So you have your own system to examine the different factors that go into making someone act gullibly.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something I necessarily invented. I have been, as far as I know, the only one who's applied this model to the specific problem of gullibility. But I really kind of borrowed it from the broader literature on motivation. At least one, usually two or more of these factors are operating. The strength of the factors depends on the person and the particular nature of that situation. So that's why it's so hard to predict gullibility, because someone can be generally not gullible, and yet in a particular situation involving a particular person, trickster, they can behave very foolishly.
So, for example, you could have someone who is intelligent, although I notice in your book you don't like to sort of think about it in terms of, you know, intelligence or IQ or that sort of intellect, but you have someone who's smart or with it, and someone who's also emotionally together, and yet given the right situation and put them in the right sort of, you know, get them drunk and put them in the right situation, for example, they're going to act gullibly regardless of their emotional and
people who are not very intelligent are much more vulnerable to being manipulated. But even very highly intelligent people can be taken advantage of, as you say, if they're intoxicated, for example, or if they're extremely fatigued. It's not an accident that military and police interrogations often start in the evening and go long into the night. When someone is exhausted, their volition becomes diminished, and their ability to think straight becomes diminished. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton has said that every mistake he's ever made occurred when he was tired. He's somebody who I think probably had a sleep disorder. He never went to bed at a reasonable hour. And the most famously foolish thing he ever did, the business with Monica Lewinsky, happened late at night.
So he can. I like, that's a good way. He's got like a.
Well, there are other factors, such as sexual arousal, the fact that Monica snapped her thong rather flirtatiously. So that would be an example of a situation. Affect or the last of the four factors comes into play when someone is sexually aroused or exhausted or inebriated or extremely agitated. As a rule, when we're really a lot of foolish behavior, and I should point out that I see gullibility as a subtype of foolishness, foolish behavior. In my next book, which I'm about to send off publishers. It's called Anatomy of Foolishness. I define foolishness as unawareness of risk or insufficient attention to risk, and gullibility is an inattention to social risk, the risk of someone claiming to be your friend but actually your enemy. When one is agitated, they're much more likely to behave foolishly.
Is by people who have acted gullibly, and for me it's always, I'm usually talking about con artists and scams. So when you have someone who's, for example, the victim of a con artist, and they'll often have difficulty explaining why they were scammed, and they'll also, people who they're telling the story to will also have difficulty understanding what happened, that, you know, why did you act so stupidly? Is it, do you think that may be because of, it is a combination of factors, that it isn't, it's rarely just one reason, it is a series of events and a series of preconditions that have created the gullible.
Absolutely. I mean, successful scammers or con artists, that's a side of it that you probably know a lot better than I do. They're very good psychologists. They're good at reading people. They know people's weaknesses. One of the weaknesses is a difficulty being assertive, or difficulty in removing themselves from the situation, or difficulty seeing through what's actually going on. So, you know, that speaks to the notion of personality. People who are more passive, more dependent on others, are easily taken advantage of. Now, interestingly, one of the tricks of a con artist that was discussed in the movie House of Games, you know, Mamet is a playwright and movie person who has made con artistry and victimization kind of his specialty. In House of Games, the con artist who's being questioned by a woman psychiatrist who wants to learn what he does, he says, "Why do they call it a confidence game? Is it because you give me your confidence?" Namely, the victim gives the con artist her confidence. "No, it's I give you my confidence." So he plays hard to get. He makes it seem that he's doing the victim a favor by letting him in on the scheme. Certainly that was true of Bernard Madoff, whose scam is something I know personally pretty well, in that he would say no to people wanting to invest $1 million or $2 million with him. He'd say, "No, the fund is closed," and they'd beg him, and they'd come back and double or triple the amount of money they gave him, because he was giving them his confidence.
Yeah, I heard also when people would ask to take their money out, he would say absolutely and write them a check on the spot and just slide the check across the table and make a big deal of, you know, almost rushing them out of the scheme to create an air of regret instantly. So rather than, you know, making it a slow process, we're right, yes, absolutely, here's your check. You know, if you're not interested in making more money, of course, there's your money, take it away. You know, I know, you know, and people, of course, would panic at suddenly being set free and put their money back in. You said personal experience, and you mentioned in the book, so you lost money yourself to Madoff?
Well, I didn't say it in the book. That's something that came out right after the book was published. So, yeah, the book was published in December of 2008. No, was it 8 or 9?
Yeah, and 2009.
I really didn't have much in the book. Well, the book came out in January 2009, but I think I held the first copy in my hand in early December of 2008. And I dealt with financial gullibility in a minor way in the book. It was really not one of my major emphases. I talked, of course, about tulip mania in Holland and Mississippi mania in France, the South Sea bubble in the Britain. But that was pretty much it. So I get a call 2 days, actually 2 days after I had the book in my hand. I think it was December 10th. I get a call from my broker, the man who got me into a particular hedge fund. And he said, "Terrible news, Bernard Madoff is running a Ponzi scheme." To which I replied, "Who is Bernard Madoff and what does he have to do with me?" And it turned out that this hedge fund in which I had moved a large chunk of my retirement savings was one of the so-called Madoff feeder funds. It was one of the larger ones, I think. They had something like $3 billion and assets that were pretty much all turned over to Madoff. I didn't really know that. All I knew is that it was a good fund in terms of their safe, but seemingly safe and steady, modest but very steady returns. So I was obviously rather upset by this news. So I, in my own way of dealing with that, I wrote an article. I submitted it to Skeptic magazine. I know the editor, Michael Shermer, slightly. That was posted online, where it was seen by the Wall Street Journal, and they called me and asked if they could reprint it. I got permission from Shermer, and it went somewhat viral because it came out only three weeks after the Madoff story, and it was really the first attempt by an academic to try to explain why smart people, not just it's people who are knowledgeable about investments. Many of the victims were knowledgeable investments. The managers of the hedge funds obviously were knowledgeable about investments, and yet quite a few of them turned all their money over to. But then someone like myself, supposedly an expert on gullibility, but not really an expert on finance, obviously. I, in fact, had dismissed concerns expressed by a friend of mine, told not to do it. So that's where I presented this model. The model was only briefly discussed in the book in the first chapter and not really used systematically in the book, which is mainly a collection of gullibility stories. In my new book, Anatomy of Gullibility, I used the model attractively. But the model was in the Wall Street Journal piece, which is a very widely read newspaper. And the interesting thing is I got a lot of calls from or emails from people in the investment industry, fairly famous people in the investment industry, in fact, telling me that I really had something useful here. So recently there was a book on Ponzi schemes published in Australia by Edward Elgar Press, and it's called Understanding Ponzi Schemes. There's a whole chapter devoted to Greenspan's theory of Ponzi schemes. So I went from a victim of a Ponzi scheme to someone who's sort of an expert.
Well, a lot of the people I speak to, their story begins with themselves being scammed or someone they love being scammed or some sort of personal situation that sparks their interest. But in your case, it sounded, I shouldn't say good luck, but coincidence that at that moment, you have this book coming out and you have an understanding of the topic and also this very personal, practical example to share with people. But I mean, based on what you've said, though, it doesn't sound like you were gullible, as I understand gullibility, in that you obviously trusted your broker, who is a financial expert. And as you said, you're open about your lack of knowledge of financial matters. And so you trusted people who should know what they're doing and who turned out they didn't. To me, is there a difference between being trusting and being gullible? Because I don't know, I'm not sure I necessarily see you as in that situation.
Well, that's a very interesting question. Gullibility is not a topic that's been addressed much in the social sciences, including psychology, in part because it's too complicated. There are too many ways of, too many factors that contribute to it. One of the few famous psychologists who's written about gullibility is a man named Julian Roeder, who actually was at the same university. I was at the University of Connecticut, but we were in different departments, plus he was pretty elderly at that point, so I never really got to know him, although I did talk to him about gullibility. He wrote a very famous article about gullibility where he discussed the difference between trust and gullibility, because he's mainly known for his reading or research about, I'm blocking the construct, but locus of control. But he also did write quite a bit about interpersonal trust. And so he addressed the question, is gullibility the same thing as trust? Obviously, trust is one of the contributing factors in gullibility. And if we look at gullibility in terms of individual differences, people who are extremely trusting are more likely to be gullible. But and he also looked at it in terms of intelligence. And what he found is that gullibility is not the same thing as trust. It's a particular type of trust that he called foolish or naive trust. So there are usually warning factors, almost always are. And we, because we have an affective need for a particular course of action or are desperate for a certain outcome, we put these on the shelf, sort of self-deception, so that people who are intelligent or have certain kinds of intelligence, such as social intelligence, Well, I'm very interested in intelligence. I believe that IQ is too limited an aspect of intelligence. People who are sharp, particularly sharp, they may be very trusting. And for example, in finance, virtually all financial transactions operate on the basis of trust. Very often, there are not contracts. There are not formal manifestations of trust. People are trusting. It would be a grim world if we didn't trust people. I think what makes me not generally gullible is that there are other situations. Someone tried to talk to me about a tax evasion scam. Quickly saw through. I said, "He's not going to touch that." He actually wound up going to jail eventually. All the people who listened to him wound up losing all their money. So, you know, on the other hand, I was gullible with regard to this one particular scheme. But the interesting thing about the Madoff scheme, which was so successful, is that so many knowledgeable people. There were so few people who had the wisdom to say, "Wait a minute, something wrong." Now it's very interesting. I after my Wall Street Journal paper came out, I started getting calls to participate in interviews and conferences of various kinds. And I get a call from a psychoanalyst. I'm not a psychoanalyst. I'm a psychologist, but a research psychologist. But I don't consider myself a psychoanalyst, although there are certain aspects of this multidimensional causative theory that are broadly compatible with psychodynamic approach. But he was having a conference in New York, a psychoanalytic conference on money, also sex. So he wanted me to talk about Elliot Spitzer, who was in the governor of New York, whose career crashed and burned when he got caught up in a prostitution thing. But the main focus of the conference was on money. And so I was on a panel with some people who were very interested in the topic of Madoff, which at that time was very much in the news. So there was a man on the panel who actually is hired by hedge funds to check out, to vet their investments. And he was hired by a French hedge fund operator named Villaché. It's a long series of names, but that was his last name. And he had $2 billion of investors in France, including his own family, who had a great deal of money invested in this Madoff fund. So this gentleman told me that he came back to Villaché and he said, "There's some real problems here. You need to pull your money out right away. You're very much at risk." And Villaché said, "Well, why should I believe you?" The SEC, which is the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is an American government agency that regulates the financial industry, had checked him out and they didn't pursue anything. So why should I believe you? Well, Villaché wound up losing everything and ended up committing suicide. Very tragic outcome. So what this gentleman pointed out as red flags were, first of all, Madoff, it was an unusual arrangement. He didn't charge the usual hedge fund exorbitant fees. He charged only for these transactions, the sort of brokerage fee, which is why he had to continually seem to be investing, buying and selling. And so this man who checked it out said, "Wait a minute, billions of dollars are changing hands, or many hundreds of millions. I don't know anybody in the finance industry who's handled any of these transactions. How is this possible?" Then, of course, Madoff had continuous positive returns every quarter, every year, every month, even at times when everyone else was losing money. And also Madoff, whose other – he had two firms, one sort of handled penny stock transactions and the other was this investments scheme. His other firm actually pioneered the use of electronic trading slips. There were no electronic trading slips, so they were all handwritten trading slips. And furthermore, they weren't time-stamped. So there were just so many red flags. And mm-hmm. Barron's Magazine had a story about Madoff almost calling him a fraudster. And nobody, none of these people pursued it. And the reason was because they had too much emotionally invested, not only financially invested.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the question, "Why should I trust you?" Which is one that seems to be repeated more and more in our, and I hate to say it, post-truth world. That's that phrase that everybody is saying. But now we are in an era of fake news, of political leaders who are quite happy to openly lie and then say that they didn't lie later on when presented with irrefutable evidence, and yet we still are happy to trust them. I mean, I don't want to talk, about Trump for the next hour and drive us both insane, but it's clear that people are acting gullibly. So what are the techniques that we can use to protect ourselves from being taken advantage of, or to minimize the amount of gullible actions that we perform? Because I know you sort of dedicated the last chapter or so to the book with a few techniques to protect yourself. What do you think is the most important thing?
Probably the most important one is to, when you find yourself in a situation where you feel pressured or where you feel uncertain, the best thing you could do is give yourself more time. There's a very highly regarded book by a psychologist / economist named Kahneman, Daniel Kahneman, recently called Thinking Fast and Slow. And basically, to simplify it, there are two kinds of cognition. He called it fast and slow. Others, such as Walter Mischel, call it hot versus cold. Generally speaking, hot cognition is thinking while we're in an intuitive state or in a rush state or in an emotional state, or in a state where we're being pressured. Gullibility always involves some degree of manipulation, whether it's by one person or many people. For example, in the case of an investment scam, usually this pressure not only from the scamster, but from all the other people who are telling you what a good deal it's been for them. The best thing to do is to pull back. Never allow yourself to be rushed. Seek other advice. Recognize when you're vulnerable or when you're in a situation where that your weaknesses come into play. Seek out advice or help from others who may have more experience in this particular topic. So those would be things that kind of roughly fall under the rubric of situation. In terms of cognition, I'm assuming you're referring to things like the false news websites that seem to be proliferating. And it was, I forget his name, but the gentleman a couple days ago who had no history of violence or criminal behavior, but who believed the news that there was a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C., I believe, where the Clinton people were running a sex ring for children in the basement. So he walks in there with a... Huh? Pizzagate, right. He walks in there with a rifle looking for the children that he can save. Amazingly credulous that he would believe that.
It's extraordinary. In that case, there is... just pages and pages and pages of evidence, of proof that this is the case, that each individual piece of evidence that is presented is ridiculous. You know, it's a picture of a child eating a slice of pizza and that's considered a evidence for a child sex ring, on their Facebook page. And then there's another one in which there's a weird use of the word pizza. I can't remember the exact phrase, but it's, pizza isn't being used grammatically correctly, and the reason being is that it's a code for, you know, for the child sex. And it's when presented with an individual piece of evidence, in inverted commas, like that, it's ridiculous. But when even someone like me, when presented with the stream of that, you do need to actually take a step back and say, wait a minute, this is pareidolia. You know, this is seeing patterns where patterns don't exist. And for people who aren't thinking critically, I mean, it's very difficult to disengage yourself from that, you know, certainly not quality of evidence, but quantity of evidence.
Yeah, I mean, there are some cognitive fallacies operating. If you can't prove that something is wrong, that these people assume that means that it's happening or it hasn't been disproven. Epictetus, the famous Greek Stoic philosopher, said that, quote, something like, take the time to study clear thinking so you won't be hoodwinked. So one way of, I mean, the average person is not going to probably do that, but there are certain cognitive fallacies that operate that cause people to be susceptible to ridiculous conspiracy theories like that, that take advantage of their beliefs and highly conspiratorial, paranoid kinds of beliefs.
It's difficult, I think, to draw that line between being skeptical of information that you are presented with and to be completely mistrusting of all the information that you're presented with. It is to look at the world cynically. that there has to be a degree of trust in the information that you're given. You can't sort of assume that all news is fake until proven otherwise. You do need to sort of trust at some point. I spent the last weekend, I hosted the dinner of the Australian Skeptics Convention, and so spent the night with a lot of skeptics. And the people I spoke to fell into two categories, which was the people who were interested in science and critical thinking and very sort of open and keen to talk about ideas. And the other half were quite cynical and refused to really accept anything outside of what they could necessarily prove scientifically. And it must be difficult to, you know, to move from one to the other.
Well, highly cynical people, I consider some gullible, because they assume that their conspiratorial view of the world is accurate. And probably a good example of that would be paranoids. You think of paranoids as having a position of extreme distrust, but they're extremely trusting of whatever fits into their particular conspiratorial worldview. And an example of that would be probably suicide bombers or terrorists. I mean, they're highly gullible towards the people who manipulate them, who recruit them. And they tend to see the world in terms of a very single and simple explanation, such as that Israel is bad. So cynicism is not a particularly healthy perspective, nor does it necessarily protect you from gullibility. I mean, people who are skeptical have an open, they don't necessarily immediately agree, but they don't necessarily automatically disagree either.
The guests I find most interesting are the ones who are very quick to point out the limits of their own knowledge and to offer caveats and to say, look for the, you know, the shades of gray or the things which aren't proven.
I talk about that in the book, that the people who I consider extremely smart, the smartest people I know, they don't have any problem saying, I don't know.
And I guess that's part of the goal of science in general is to figure out what we do know and also be more than happy to admit when what we thought was previously true is in fact wrong, is to be able to sort of step back and say, this is what we believed before, or this is what we thought was true, but the new evidence tells us this new piece of information, and being able to accept that seems like that's
Absolutely.
An important thing. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Just to finish up, you mentioned briefly some of the great the sort of gullibility in fiction and literature. What are some of your favorites? Who are some of your great gullible characters or works that you enjoy? You mentioned the Confidence Man, which is Herman Melville.
Well, yeah, the Confidence Man was his last work, actually. And he wrote it when he was financially stressed, so it was serialized, and it's a somewhat uneven, but it's about a trip on a paddle wheel steamer going down the Mississippi to New Orleans, where the devil in disguise, and of course the devil is a great deceiver, the great deluder, takes advantage of all kinds of people, including a man who is a firm disbeliever in patent medicines. The devil convinces him to buy some patent medicines, and he has a shave or a haircut, and the barber has a sign, no trust, and he ends up tricking him out of a free haircut.
The Russians, you know, it's a 20th century Russian literature. They love gullible, both tricksters and gullible characters. You know, like Dead Souls, and you mentioned The Idiot, and The Little Golden Calf, and 12 Chairs, and all those stories about not just con artists and tricksters, but people acting foolishly and acting gullibly. Which I guess under communist rule, particularly some of the later books, was clearly had a lot to say about politics.
Yeah, I mentioned Little Red Riding Hood was pretty gullible, and the Pied Piper. I mean, both German classics about the need for children to be more careful and not fall for tricks. Of course, the Bible has several gullibility stories: the serpent in the Garden of Eden, tricking Eve into eating the apple by saying, don't worry, God doesn't really mean it, which condemned the rest of us to being mortal. And then, of course, Samson and Delilah, Samson being tricked by Delilah into revealing the source of his strength.
What I love about Samson and Delilah, there's a classic bar bet that you can use to win free drinks in bars, where you start a casual conversation about Samson and Delilah with someone, and say, but you don't mention Delilah by name. And you say, you might say, you know, Samson and, or, you know, the one who cut off Samson's hair. You know, the one who cut off Samson's hair, and they always answer Delilah. And you go, no, 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 the one who cut off Samson's hair. And they insist Delilah. And you keep having this back and forth argument with them about who cut off Samson's hair in the Bible until eventually you have to act a little drunk, you know, slam $50 and go, I bet you $50 that it wasn't this Delilah person who cut off Samson's hair. And when you open the Bible to the appropriate passage, it says, and Delilah sent forth a servant who cut off Samson's hair. And you win the fair bet on a technicality. So it's a nice way to
Adventures of Tom Sawyer, the famous fence painting story where he got everybody to pay him in order to help him paint whitewash the fence. And then, of course, he also wrote a book called The Gilded Age, which was about Madoff type financial gullibility. Gulliver in Gulliver's Travels. I think the word Gulliver had something to do with his gullibility.
Yeah, it's been a while since I studied it, but I remember that all of the names are plays on words and are, you know, they're either puns or references to real people. In fact, I remember being just absolutely delighted in university, being told that we read the first chapter, and when it was pointed out to me that Gulliver was talking about his boss, whose name was Master Bates. And so in the first chapter, the word Master Bates appears like a dozen times, and I'd never noticed it. And
probably the greatest gullibility story in world literature, and of course there are many, is Othello, Shakespeare's Othello, where Othello is tricked by his assistant Iago into believing that his wife, Desdemona,
but again, I guess the thing is we tell these stories over and over and over again, and yet we don't always learn from them. It's part of that problem of human nature is that it doesn't matter how many times you warn us, if those factors are in place, we're still going to act gullibly. We're still going to act foolishly given the right circumstances.
Well, you asked what's the most important factor, and I mean, all of these things are important, but probably the most important is emotion. You know, when emotion kicks in, reason tends to go out the window.
So all we need to do is get rid of emotion, what we said.
Yeah, one should definitely not make any major decision when you're in the grips of strong emotion.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it. So your previous book is the Annals of Gullibility, How We Get Duped and How to Avoid It. And your new book, which is out next year, is Anatomy of Gullibility.
No, Anatomy of Foolishness.
Anatomy of Foolishness.
Excellent. Of which gullibility is a major subtype.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
This has been Scammapalooza. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au.